You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Carlton Shield Chief Gover. Joining me today for episode 30 is Nolan Johnson. Nolan is an archaeologist with the Office of the State Archaeology Office in Nebraska. Did I mess that up or is that about close enough?
State Archaeology Office, so pretty close.
State Archaeology Office, excellent. And I've known Nolan, I've known you close to a decade at this point.
Yeah, I know we met out at when you were at the Lynch site for sure, but I know I knew you when you were at Wyoming or
Yeah.
I met you when you were in master's school for sure.
At my first Plains conference when I think I was talking to Rob and his whole crew in Bismarck.
Yeah, the Nebraska people, we always travel in a posse at all times. So
yeah, you guys and Bob Horde used to have a pack too. All the Kansas archaeologists used to.
Yeah, they don't come in as many historical society people from Kansas. Not so many anymore. But
nah, but there'll be a bunch at Iowa City. Iowa's gonna be fun.
Yeah.
Well, I'm super stoked to have you on the podcast because we've also got to work together a couple times in the field. Where I got to tag along to some of your projects.
Yeah.
And come to Lincoln somewhat frequently, at least once or twice a year. So super excited to have you on the podcast. Yeah, it's gonna be a fun time.
Yeah, I agree.
So there's something you need to state overlords.
For my bosses, I've worked at the State Historical Society my whole career. It's pushing 19 years. But for the purposes of this podcast, my views are my own and do not represent the state of Nebraska.
There we go. Appreciate the disclaimer, man. So I'm really excited to have Nolan on. Nolan, you're really good at public archaeology, working with the State Archaeology Office. Both Rob Bozell, who was on the previous episode 29, and now with Dave Williams. But one of your major strengths in Nebraska archaeology is historic archaeology. So like post 1492, and mostly more in particular, right? It's like the American archaeology.
Yeah, Euro-American settlement of Nebraska. I've done quite a bit of work there. I was really fortunate when I came to UNL for graduate school. I didn't have a thesis project. That's one thing, you know, if you're a young kid going to go to grad school, they're going to ask you, well, what do you want to do for your thesis? And I was like, I don't know, you know, but there was a professor, Dr. Paul Demers, who was into borders and frontiers and stuff. And he had got hooked up with the guy who had a Oregon Trail road ranch on his farm in a pasture, never been plowed up. The trail ruts were there. The ford of the creek was still there. You could see the well. The hole for the well was still there. There was kind of a hump where the building had kind of collapsed. And he was going to teach field school. And it was in, you know, it was like 40 miles from Lincoln. So we were driving a big van every day back and forth. I don't think anyone else was really excited about doing that field school. So he needed a TA and I'm like, I will do it. And so I was the TA out at Beaver Crossing for 2 summers and it was a great site, really interesting. The field school students were great. We had a really good time. And, you know, historic archaeology, especially that site was in the 1860s mostly. And we had a photo. We had a photo of the building we were excavating. So I can't tell you how many times we're standing out there, you know, in the field with the photo being like, well, if they took it from this angle, that means, you know, it's got to be this way. And then we dug a hole and we're like, well, that didn't work. So what if they're over here and we'll dig over here and we try that for a while. And yeah, just staring at this photo for hours, trying to triangulate where this building exactly sat, you know, out in the prairie was pretty interesting.
And I imagine back then, right, they didn't have the same growth of trees down at the creek. It would have been much more open.
Yeah, the Beaver Creek is a pretty big stream that flows into the Blue River. The site is on what's called the Nebraska City Cutoff. It's a straight shot from Nebraska City, Nebraska to Fort Kearney, kind of a time saver. A guy pioneered it who had created a steam wagon, which was like it was just this massive steam tractor that he said was going to haul 12 wagons at a time. And so he created this trail and left Nebraska City in 1862 to all this fanfare. And then his contraption broke down a half mile out of town and it never moved again. And people scavenged it. And if you go to the Old Freighters Museum in Nebraska City, which you should do, they have a piece of it. And I finally got there and took a picture of it. And it was like, you know, like the journey had been complete, right? When I got to see the chunk of the thing. And so that's why the trail we were at was there. And but the Beaver Creek might have had a few trees, but I'm sure they cut them down right away for firewood. And the people there, again, because it's historic, you know, we got family histories and newspapers. And, you know, we knew a lot about these guys who owned the road ranch. And the business model is genius, right? Everybody had to come there to ford the creek because it was all gravelly. And even to this day, the stream bed is just full of gravel, right, instead of mud. So it's a nice place to cross the stream. And so all the traffic funnels right there. And they would sell people supplies and stuff. But what they would do is when you got there, you know, if you had, say you had a pair of worn out oxen or whatever, they would take your worn out animals, two of them, and give you one new one, basically a fresh one for a 2-to-1. And then they would just turn the worn ones out on the pasture till they fattened up on all the, you know, the 6-foot prairie grass. Until the next guy came and they trade those. So it's like they were just this ever expanding herd of critters because people just needed fresh ones all the time. And so that was, it was quite the model, the business plan.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I can imagine how desperate people would have been to like trade in their two to get one. That's pretty slick.
To get something that looks healthy again. Yeah. And Beaver Crossing was a real interesting site because when we started, again, it never been plowed. So we were all like, we're going to find the foundation. We're going to find the fireplace. We're going to find where the door was. We're going to be like, we're going to know exactly where this building was. Right. And so we start digging. And all we're finding is these little bitty limestone rocks and these kind of, we call them mortar schmears, just these kind of amorphous blobs of mortar and little tiny brick fragments and rocks kind of just spewing about, right? And we had even had the Midwest Archaeological Center came out and did some geophys stuff. And so we had, a really good idea of where this thing should be. And we just kept digging and we're like, why is there no structural material? There's just nothing here. It's all broken and little and tiny. And the dirt was super hard, like super hard. There was one day in a moment of weakness, I had these two geologic picks my parents had gotten me. And I just started hammering the dirt with these mini pickaxes because it was like, I couldn't take it anymore, you know, because it was just so hard. The dirt was so hard. But we did eventually figure it out when we started to get some bigger units open and some profiles. You know, we kind of figured out, and it's what I ended up writing my thesis about, is that we knew that this was the town site of Beaver Crossing. They had a post office and a general store, you know, all in one building, right? And we knew that in 1871, trail traffic's drying up, and people were building a grist mill on the Blue River, and the railroad was coming to the current town site of Beaver Crossing. So we knew the people moved, but they must have tore every single usable rock and board and bolt and nail out of that building and moved it to the new town, because there were spots, which was really wild. And, you know, in our Carlton, you know very well, archaeologists love a good story, right?
Oh, yeah. And
there was a guy at my work named John Carter who used to say, never let facts get in the way of a good story, right? So in the profiles of these walls, and I could show you pictures, there would be kind of a clump of mortar, right? And then you could trace kind of these mortar dribbles, and it really looked exactly like if you had to dig down to get your foundation stone out of the ground and then kind of pull it up and away from the foundation trench, and you're kind of leaving mortar as you go. And so it was like that had to be what was happening. And so, you know, after we figured that out, well, then the story becomes, well, this is an excavation about how a site looks that the occupants had just totally deconstructed, right? And how that shows up in the archaeological record rather than, you know, a building that had just kind of been left to molder and fall in place. And so that story is really interesting. And it really tied in when I wrote my thesis. I read a lot of, you know, trail travel stuff. And there's this real interesting kind of dichotomy of people when they start out on the trail. You read all this stuff about, you know, they got great grandma's china and they're bringing like hutches and furniture and cast iron cauldrons and all sorts of nonsense. And then, you know, 5 miles in, they're like out the wagon. They're just throwing stuff away. But at the same time, there are people who, especially out west, who would just go back and forth on the trail and just scavenge what everybody else had thrown away. And so it's this weird kind of, we got to get rid of this stuff. And then someone else will be like, you know, treasure and take the stuff and reuse it. So it's this wholesale reuse of everything that kind of was on the trail encapsulated in this one little place.
So, and I'm going to link this in the show notes, but on the Nebraska State Historical Society's blog, Archaeology at the Beaver Creek Trail Crossing. And is this the photo you guys had lined up of the Roland Reed Ranch?
Yeah, with the building and kind of the people in front.
Yeah, and the horses, and there's not a tree in sight.
Not a tree in sight. No.
I can just see you guys trying to figure out where the hell it is.
Just like, where? Nothing. And the well, you know, you can see the well in that picture. So we kind of knew, and we found the trash pit and the privy for the business, and that had to be in the back. You know, you had trail, well, and then building, and then your outhouse is behind, right? That's just business. You're not going to put your outhouse out front for all the travelers to use, right? You don't want that.
Right.
And so we kind of knew, but you know, that picture, that's a substantial log and wood frame. That's a substantial structure.
That's a nice little A-frame house.
Yeah, it's a regular A-frame house. Yeah. And a wattle and daub chimney kind of leaning off. And then like there's kind of a shed roof, you know, like a sod roof shed attachment on the one side. So there should have been, like when we started, they're like, there should be all this stuff. There should be all this stuff. And there was not much stuff. And it took, you know, it took probably the whole first field season till we really kind of got a handle on it. And we're like, oh, now we get it. Now it all comes together, you know.
But, and that's a clean geophys survey from MWAC.
Yeah, like, it was a great geophys. And when we, again, once we sort of knew, we're like, oh, there's like four, there was about three blobs where are the corners of what's left of the building. And you're like, well, of course, the corner the two walls meet, there's more stuff left. And so once you kind of filled in that missing corner, you're like, oh, okay, it's right here. But it's not a nice, you know, I've seen ones they've done where it's like, you know, it's like they got a Roman villa under there or some nonsense. You know, it's perfect geometric designs, but we did not have that benefit for sure.
That's pretty clean. No, that's a fun story. That's good. I'm going to link this blog on the show notes for those that are interested. Like, that picture is just so typical Nebraska. But then it's, and like the modern day landscape is gorgeous with that sloping hill, and you can see all those cottonwoods in the back. Like, that's,
yeah, it's it, yeah. And you, when you were down there, there's a farm nearby, but you can't see it because of the trees. And we're 4 miles off of the nearest kind of two-lane highway, and so there's no road traffic and there's no telephone poles down there you can see. So it's really like it was 150 years ago. Because there's no, you can't see fields because it's just pasture, because it's all kind of wet down there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was good.
Well, that's pretty clean. All right, we'll be right back with Nolan Johnson here in episode 30 after these messages. And welcome back to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I am still here with Nolan Johnson at the Office of the State Archaeologist in the state of Nebraska. I get that mixed up because that's how it is at Kansas, and I'm just, now that I'm here, it's always Office of the State Archaeologist. Anywho, so that was a really fun conversation that we had about the Beaver Creek crossing site. That's in the 1860s, Civil War is going off out east. But something that we haven't talked too much about on this show, Rob talked about the engineer cantonment, you know, as a case study of historic archaeology. But what does the post-1492 record of Nebraska look like? Is the first instance arrival of Europeans in Nebraska, is that the Easter expedition or are there earlier travels?
There's a map from, I think 1718, a French map that has an accurate drawing of Nebraska, the major rivers, and where the tribal folks would have probably been. Now, that's probably a French guy heard that from some natives and extrapolated it. We know there were probably French fur traders out there in the early 1700s. Yeah, Via Sur, absolutely there. 1720 gets massacred by the Loup and Platte River and runs away. Spanish guy, the Pawnee, your people sent him packing. And so, yeah, that's kind of the first really documented, as far as I know, of where we know that site's never been found. It's probably washed away and the Loup and the Platte shift around so much. But we know generally where that was at and, you know, the exact day of when that happened. And, you know, and then you get in the late 1700s, you start to get some traders setting up forts. They called them forts, more like trading posts along the Missouri River. There was one named Fort Carlos, probably because of Spanish, up in northeast Nebraska. You get Manuel Lisa setting up near Omaha, and there's Cabernet's post by Omaha, and some other guys, you know, on the Missouri River setting up traders in the late 17 and early 1800s.
I do have to say, I'm rather disappointed because that 1718 map, which is, what's the name of it?
Mallet or Bird?
It's like the Carte Louisiane Etoucour du Mississippi by something de Lisle, but that the Republican River, they called it the River of Pawnees. And yeah. I really wish, or the Platte.
It used to be
the Pawnee River, and they got rid of it.
Yeah.
They changed the name.
It's named after the Americanized, whichever band the Republican Pawnee are. I don't know the Pawnee names of the bands, but one of them is referred.
Yes. So one of them, and that's a French thing, because the French called them the Republic Pawnees.
Yeah. And so it's the Americanized French version of what the French called that band of Pawnee is the what the Republican River is named. So kind of.
It's lost in translation.
But yeah, a little bit.
It's the Kickahawkee River. Yeah, because the Republican Pawnees are the Kickahawkees. But
okay.
Yeah. But no, I love that map. It's a fun map to look at.
It is a great map.
There used to be a lot of Pawnees in Nebraska. It's like they're pretty.
It's really accurate from what the archaeological record and other groups' oral tradition. It stacks up really well.
Yeah.
But if you go a little bit farther in time in 1819, you get the Yellowstone expedition, and they set up first the Missouri Cantonment, which was down on the river bottom, and that flooded out, and that was a bad idea. And then in 1820, they build Fort Atkinson up on the bluff top. And that's, you know, the first post west of the Missouri River, you know, this United States flexing its muscle in the fur trade. And that's really the first Euro-American, you know, a big permanent Euro-American settlement in the state of Nebraska. And there's been just a ton of archaeology there way back into the 1950s. Gail Carlson, one of the smartest men I ever met, did a whole bunch of work there in the 70s and 80s and 90s, like 30 years worth of work, just tremendous stuff. If you ever get a chance, go there. Most of the buildings are recreated right on top of the archaeological excavations. So like it's accurate down to where the posts are for the porch and where the windows and the doors and the chimneys are. I don't think there's another fort that's faithfully recreated on site like that is. There are some other great forts, but that one is really special to me because it's right exactly where it was, you know. And because of all the great work that Gail did, it looks almost exactly like it did in the 1820s. And so, you know, once that fort's there for 7 years, and then it shuts down, you know, the fur trade kind of loses steam. There's a lot of interest in the Santa Fe Trail. So they send the soldiers down to Fort Leavenworth and disperse them from there. And then, you know, from what the stuff I know about really kicks off, you know, Nebraska becomes a territory in the 1850s, right? You get the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and you have a little farther south, you have Bleeding Kansas. So you got a lot of slavery stuff. There are a little bit of the Underground Railroad is in southeast Nebraska. There's a couple places that relate to that down in like Brownville and towards Nebraska City and stuff. And so that's really interesting. And then, you know, after become a territory, you get some really great river boom and bust towns, which are fun. I've worked on one called DeSoto, which has a now defunct nuclear power plant on top of it, which is really interesting for an archaeological site. But what was fun about DeSoto, and again, Gail excavated some of it for a highway project in the 70s, is that a lot of these river towns wash away, right? They're on the river and the river moves and they just wash away. DeSoto, the river went the other way. So it was this barge landing spot and the river moved like a mile away. And they're like, oh, I guess we're done here, you know, and the town just dried up and it just went away, right? They're just like, what are we going to do? And so it just stopped being a town. But we've got a bunch of archaeology, you know, from there that's never really been, it's never been, you know, reported on, because in the 70s, in the kind of the heyday of highway archaeology, not the heyday, but the Fast and Furious highway archaeology, back then it really was, they were the highway salvage archaeology program. And that's exactly what it was, right? They would get out there and the earth grader at that site had graded away, and there's all these basements from buildings, and they're out there scooping up basement fill as fast as they can. And it's still in our collections and it's probably got some really great stuff in it, but you know, nobody ever had time to go back. And we did a little testing, so we dabbled in it. But yeah, those river towns are really fun. And there's another one called Cumming City that is well reported, but it only exists and I have beef with gray literature, but it only exists in this really fun historical society publication about highway archaeology programs or projects. And so, like, unless you talk to me and I tell you about it, there's like three other people who know it exists, you know?
Yeah.
And so you get those, in the territory days, you get those fun, you get a lot of river traffic, right? You still get a lot of fur trading stuff. We got Mormon settlement there in North Omaha winter quarters, or Church of Latter-day Saints, I think would be more correct these days. But, you know, but they're setting up shop there. And then you got the trail traffic, which I've done some work on, like my thesis is on. And so, you know, that historic archaeology in Nebraska is sort of sadly a lot of people moving across the state, you know, so you get Pony Express stations and stage stations, and there's military forts, you know, that spring up and don't last very long. There's one called Fort Hartsiff that was made out of a really early kind of handmade cement. And so in the 1960s, there were still structures still standing from the 1880s because they're made out of cement, and that's a state historic park now. So that's really cool. And we've also, you know, if you go farther west, there's Fort Robinson, which was a huge military fort in its day, got its start because some of the Lakota Indian agencies were right there and later trained war dogs and war horses and had a prisoner of war camp. And we've got to do some archaeology. We tested the Red Cloud Agency, where, you know, one of the Lakota tribes, you know, received their beef rations and their not allotments, their annuities and stuff. And so they had the trading post there. And so, you know, and then, you know, we work on stuff. You know, we just spent the spring excavating a historic farmstead that's got its start in the 1860s. And yeah, there's so much this stuff that's very closely related in time. And yet, you know, it's a lot of stuff we don't know a whole lot about still, you know. So I think archaeology can fill in a lot of gaps, even from stuff that's not, you know, super old.
Excellent. And you also got Genoa Indian School.
Yeah, the Genoa Indian School. Yeah, the Pawnee Reservation and the boarding school there in Genoa. We were trying to find the cemetery. We're working hard to try to find where the cemetery was for that.
So to be clear for our listeners, it was the Pawnee School first. And one of the first students there was my great-great-grandmother, Susanna Gover.
When it was still Pawnee Reservation?
Yep. She was one of the first students there when it was still Pawnee Reservation. Then after we left, then it became the Genoa Indian Boarding School.
Yeah, Genoa the word industrial's in there somewhere.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Somewhere. Like it was
a school or something like that.
Yeah, and so there are still buildings. There's a couple big barns from that, and the industrial building is run by the Indian School Foundation. It's very well maintained. They do a nice job. And my work is helping to look for some graves from some students who are, hopefully we'll find them, that are buried there. We know kids died there, and we're just trying to find what happened to everybody.
It's been good you guys are working there, because I know we don't need to go into it, but I do know that your office has been pivotal in keeping Pawnee Nation up to date of expansions being done on those excavations. You guys are the only ones letting us know, like, hey, we have to dig a little bit further outside, just a heads up.
Yeah. We hope to get back and test some more. And we've had, you know, again, we've had some geophysics work done with ground penetrating radar. We've had cadaver dogs out there, and we've got historic maps. So we think we know where everything should be, but it's never as easy. That's why we do archaeology, right? It's never as easy. It's never Indiana Jones. It's never X marks the spot, right? And the other project that you've helped out with is we've done, you know, it's Native American, but it's still historic ages, Massacre Canyon, where some unfortunate episode in Plains Indian Warfare, you know, Lakota caught some Pawnee folks hunting bison. A bunch of them died. And we know
that, but not that many. I keep saying it was like the worst.
It's like 100
ambush.
I think we get conflated with, especially think about that time in the world, you know, 500,000 people died in the Civil War, right? There were thousands of guys were dying in a single day, right? Just lining up and shooting at each other. Plains Indian warfare was never like that, right? It's never guys standing in a line shooting at each other. There's a lot of movement and retreat and false retreat and stuff. So I think it was, and again, I'm not Pawnee, but, you know, to lose 50 or 75 people, that's a big deal.
Oh, devastating. Like, that's we had like 4,000 Pawnees left at that point. So, I mean, that was a significant number.
Yeah.
But for 800 to be ambushed in a canyon by, like, what, 2,000 warriors?
Reports vary, but a lot of warriors.
It could have been way worse is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It could have been.
It's sort of amazing. It wasn't way worse. And what, you know, that site – honestly, Carlton, when we went out there the first year, I was convinced we weren't going to find anything. Like, it's this transitory battle for one afternoon. You know, I was like, nothing. We're not finding nothing. And then, you know, a young Pawnee man named Aaron, shout out to Aaron, we were metal detecting. And I kind of was like, well, if there's going to be anything, it's going to be right where the canyon wall meets the bottom, because if stuff washes down, that's where it's going to stop, right? So he's over there waving. You know, this is a teenager. It was hot. He was not 100% engaged that first time. The second year, he came back. He was dialed in the second year. But anyway, he's out there waving his metal detector around, and it goes off, and we dig up the hit, right? And we had, thank goodness we had Doug Scott, one of the premier battlefield archaeologists in the world, right, out there with us. Used to work at the Park Service, done a lot of stuff. Came over and he looked at me and he's like, he just like pointed at it. He's like, this is it, man. And it was a really soft, perfect, you know, spent round cartridge from the right size for guns we knew the Lakota have. It was in the right spot in the canyon. It was really soft. It was old enough. And I was like, oh, man, this is the real deal. This is someone shot at these people right here, right? You know, right there. And then later we found some horse stuff and the smoking gun, you know, pardon the pun intended. We found a cartridge from a Henry rifle that was made, you know, from 1868 to 1888. The battle's in 73. We know they had that rifle. We know the Lakota had that rifle. The bullet, that casing was only made for that 20-year period. So unless some farmer is out there banging away with old ammunition, you know, this is exactly where a Lakota fired his rifle down into that canyon, and the spent cartridge just dropped. And, you know, that's one of the great things. And it had the writing on it, so we knew exactly what it was. And that's one of the great things about historic archaeology is you can get that pinpoint, you know, accuracy of what something is, you know, and you can tell people, like when I have some bottles on my desk at work, and I can show people the different lines and be like, well, this one is 1900s and this one is 1800s and this is why. And they're like, whoa. And it's like, I do it so I sound smart, but it is really fun to have that really, because people understand that, right? It's really easy to connect with people to a more modern thing because they're like, I drink glass bottles. I understand how glass bottles work. And then you can expand it back to be like, well, the first glass bottles were kind of like this. And, it, you know, you can kind of grab people in to that, to archaeology when you can connect it to something they really do understand. It's harder when I talk to people about, you know, archaic people roasting canna lilies or something in a big hole in the ground. They're like, you know, they kind of check out at that point sometimes. But when I can talk about the Oregon Trail and, you know, and people, you know, moving across the landscape in wagons and oxen and stuff like that, that's something they really can connect with. And it does, it helps, you know, get your foot in the door, right? That's what historic archaeology is really great about, connecting to the public, because it gets, it opens that conversation with something they know about.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. And that second year we found that metal arrowhead last morning.
Last hour, the very last time. Yeah. And I thought Trent and Mac found it and they called me over and I thought they were lying to me. I really did. But absolutely, that's absolutely a metal arrowhead. And that's probably from the Pawnee hunting bison with that.
Yeah, because that's where they were gutting them when they got in.
That's, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And I got one more thing, I will say, archaeology doesn't always line up with Native American oral traditions, and that's fine, right? I'm never going to tell someone they're wrong. I'm just going to say the evidence I have doesn't really match up, and that's cool. But when it does, right, when it does, when you can be out there, especially out there, we're out there with Pawnee guys doing that, when you can be like, right here, this is where this thing happened, and here's the thing. That's really magical for me, at any rate. That project was really great to be able to do that. I've done a couple other ones with Matt, the Pawnee Tippo, to be able to be like, this is right where your ancestors were doing, you know, doing Pawnee things right here. And that's really cool. And there's some stuff where the Ponca are, where we can be like, right here, this is exactly where you guys, you know, your ancestors were. And that's really great to be able to do that.
And like, Nebraska is so hard to pinpoint places because, like you said earlier, those rivers are so meandering.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like trying to even find a creek. It's like, you think could have moved like a mile away. Like, any, you know, it's just so hard to figure out exactly. But that was cool. I was so sick of goddamn rattlesnakes by the end of that 10-day project. I was so just over
it. Yeah, I'm not a big snake person either. That's for sure.
So over it. Well, Nolan, this was so much fun to have you on the podcast. Where can our listeners reach you if they have any questions or interest in Nebraska archaeology?
Yeah, my contact info is on the Nebraska State Historical Society website. You can look at there, or it's just nolan.johnson@nebraska.gov is my email, Nebraska all spelled out. I love to talk to people. I love to hear myself talk. So I'm always willing to talk to anyone about archaeology at any time, for sure.
Absolutely. And I'll put all those in the links below. And also the Nebraska State Historical Society, your guys' website is really nicely put together. And so that's always just a fun resource to kind of just look around on.
Yeah. One other thing, the Historical Society, we do have our own YouTube channel. And so there are four or five of my archaeology talks on there. If you want to know more about Nebraska archaeology, your last guest, Rob, I think he's got a dozen. I'm trying really hard to pass him. So I'm not quite halfway, but I'm,
well, he's retired.
I know I can gain some ground on him.
Excellent. I'll put that in the episode description down below too. So put all these resources. Well, man, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. For episode 31, we're going to have the state archaeologist of Kansas, Dr. Nikki Klarman. I'm going to talk to us about some Kansas archaeology on my side of the border. So, all right, until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram @Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarchpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
This The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.